Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting from our studios in New York City. I'd like to welcome all of you throughout the world to more countries. We're up to 168 countries where this program is broadcast, plus syndicated all around the nation. Today, an unusual program. Yes, we're going to start with the latest on health and how grapefruit juice could help you if you have been on a high-fat diet. Honeysuckle tea fighting the flu. Leptin can reverse uncontrolled diabetes, both type 1 and type 2. CDC scientist says he would never inject his pregnant wife with a flu vaccine because of all the mercury. And a lot more on health. Then from our Environmental Watch today, watching our health go up in smoke, a special report by a group representing Truth Out, including Brian Munch, on the incineration industry. Very important. Also, the world is warming faster than we thought. Then I'm going to have a guest, Louise Habakkuk, who's going to talk about fearless parenting, breaking away from the mainstream of corporate and medical parenting. And I'll be asking her to address the several studies reporting that unvaccinated children are healthier than those who are fully vaccinated, as well as yesterday, Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the U.S. National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, told a Canadian press that, quote, it's quite conceivable, if not likely, that fast-track Ebola vaccines may have to be given to entire countries, every single person. Why? And I'll give you more on the Ebola virus and why we're overreacting to it, but that'll come. And then at the end of the show, the last 17 minutes, a very special discussion with Gary Webb. Gary, of course, is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author who wrote a very important work that was published in a San Francisco paper that showed that the CIA had allowed the importation of drugs from South America, knew about it, covered it up, but more importantly, how the mainstream media attacked Webb and destroyed his career. So you'll have Gary Webb, in his own words, discussing this on a program we did back then, and then brand new information today and about a respected German journalist blowing the whistle on how the CIA controls the media, including people working for the Washington Post. Now, in this interview, you'll hear how Gary Webb calls out a reporter who was proven to work for the CIA, for the Washington Post, whose beat was covering the CIA. But this particular journalist that I'm going to refer to today is Joseph Alsop, one of the leading syndicated columnists in America. So, as you see, we have a lot of issues from perspectives that are strictly progressive to take on. Let's begin. Wouldn't it be nice if people just didn't have those high-fat diets? But they do. And unfortunately, there's little that you and I are going to do to inform them in such a manner that they would want to make it a change. People generally come to these changes more often than not because of a crisis. They get scared. Their doctor says, your cholesterol's so high, your blood monitor is so high, like triglycerides, that if you do not lower your blood fats, you're going to die, or they've had a heart attack or stroke. Other than that, probably no more than 3 to 4% of the American population actively try to look at the quality of the fats in their diet, bring in the good fats, and eliminate the bad fats. So let's just say that we have people in our lives who are not going to be as concerned about their diet or fat as we might be or want them to be. So what can we do? Well, this is easy. This is from University of California, Berkeley, published in PLOS One, done at the Department of Nutritional Science and Toxicology at the university. Quote, "It is common knowledge that a diet high in fat can lead to weight gain, but could drinking grapefruit juice reduce this effect? A new study by researchers, University of California, Berkeley, claims that's exactly what happened. Even lowered blood glucose levels and improved insulin tolerance in this laboratory study." Now, we've known, by the way, we didn't need this study to show the grapefruit has been hailed for its weight loss effect since the 1930s. In fact, Gaylord Houser, who was the leading nutritionist to most of the personalities in Hollywood who were into health, including Gloria Swanson, and she swore by grapefruit every day, and a lot of others did as well. And there was something to that, and it formed the basis of what was called the Hollywood diet. And grapefruit can help with fat-burning enzymes that promote rapid weight loss. That's a scientific fact. Here's what they found in this study. Quote, "Relatively few human studies have examined the effects of grapefruit or grapefruit juice consumption per se on metabolism in well-controlled experiments, and these have produced intriguing results. In this study," that's what they set out to do, "they found that grapefruit juice curbed weight gain, lowered blood glucose, and in the experiment where they were on a high-fat diet, and it was for 100 days. So, there's no other juice that we know that will do this. Other juices do other good things. So here is the takeaway message. Let's just say that we have a parent or a sibling that thinks we're a little bizarre or eccentric because we want to be on a healthy diet. Try to encourage them to drink one glass of grapefruit juice after a meal. And whatever meal of the day they had the most fat in, for some it might be breakfast, sausages, bacon. And if you've noticed now, they've come up with this new burger where I just saw this, I couldn't believe it. There's a huge bun, and the bun is loaded with cheese and bacon, but lots of bacon. What would be, I'm guessing, around 4 strips of bacon. And that's all pure saturated fat, and it's loaded with heterocyclic amines, and it's just terrible. But people like the taste of it, and then they're getting a hamburger on top of that, and then they're getting a sausage patty on top of that. I mean, this thing looks like it's about 8 or 9 inches thick. So that's the new norm. So breakfast for a lot of people is their highest fat meal of the day. So my suggestion, if they don't do anything else, if they won't listen to you, ask them to drink a glass of grapefruit juice. That's not too bizarre. That's not too extreme. It's not too eccentric for the people. And it could help them. It could make a big difference. All right? Simple and easy. And for everyone else, you should have it for the right reasons. Because it can help you cleanse, detoxify. Great for your intestines. We are a nation that worry a lot. And we express it in different ways. Jealousy, really a toxic emotion. And moodiness. And motivating towards things or people we want or demand to do things for us, whether they like it or not or should. The dominance factor. You know, people have to control the outcome of everything in their lives, they think. And the more powerful they are, the more they expect to control the outcome, not only in their life, but saying things without considering, how would this impact the person? How would I feel if someone spoke to me this way? But they don't. Rare is the person that says something that's inappropriate, insensitive, and then says, let me check myself. What I just said was stupid. And it's my immaturity for saying it. And I'm sorry. And can you accept that I learned my lesson, but at your cost? And I mean that. That's what we should say. But we don't. Instead, people double down. You know, they get into a riff and they can't get out of it. and then they raise their voice, they scream, they yell, they say things. It happens all the time. It shouldn't. Now here's the question. So it's a day later, a week later. Maybe it hasn't happened again. So what's the big deal? It's a big deal. Here is the unseen side of your jealousies, your worries, your moodiness, and your anger. This is a major big deal. Quote, from the news reporting staff, news editor, Mental Health Weekly, this is a mainstream publication, and this was published in the American Academy of Neurology's journal, Neurology. Worry, jealousy, moodiness linked to higher risks of Alzheimer's in women. Women who are anxious, jealous, or moody and distressed are at a greater risk of developing Alzheimer's later in life. This is a 40-year-long study that's just been reported this week. Quote, most Alzheimer's research has been devoted to factors such as education, heart and blood risks, head trauma, family history, and genetics. This is according to Professor Johansson of the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. Quote, personality may influence the individual's risk of dementia through its effects on behavior, lifestyle, or stress and reactions to stress. Neuroticism involves being easily distressed and personality traits such as worrying, moodiness, jealousy. People who are neurotic are more likely to express anger, guilt, envy, anxiety, depression. Introversion is described as shyness and reserve and is associated with being outgoing. So, the emotions that we express on a regular basis, we're not talking about one-off, we're talking about regular patterns of behavior. They're killing you. We pay a price. Remember what I said once? Every thought you have, every action in life is an exchange of energy. I'm just about ready to do a new lecture on this. I'm completing some new ideas. And once I do, I'll announce it. We can have a discussion. But I'll just reiterate what I can absolutely positively prove scientifically, as well as through common sense and reason, that there is no such thing in life as a non-cause and effect. Every single thing you do in your life, every single thought you have, and we have 50,000 thoughts per day, per person, will have an impact, either constructive or destructive, at some point in life. And then one day you wake up, and you're 40, 45, 50, 55, and now you have migraines, or you have pains that you didn't have before, or you suddenly have a blood profile that's scaring you. That didn't happen yesterday. Didn't happen from a bad meal or one-night binge. That happened by the behavior that you refused to address and change, and now it's tipped, just like the environmental tipping points. Now, that's not fatalistic. We can do an awful lot to help and reverse that and improve and repair, but that requires 100% commitment. Can't get away with doing little bits and pieces at that point. If you want to reverse the damage, you have to put more energy into the problem than what caused it. What I call the laws of compensation. To the degree that you have anything that's wrong, you must exceed the energy of how it was created in order to reverse the underlying epigenetic energy that caused it. That may sound a little esoteric, but if you understand esoteric energies, they're very powerful. Very powerful. In fact, they're probably the main reason most people end up having personality problems later in life or emotional problems later in life. But anyhow, what they're saying is, if you have Alzheimer's, wow. So wouldn't it make sense then, everyone who has Alzheimer's, that you give them an emotional protocol to help them, and that will also make a difference? I might mention that we're going to be doing a new health support group, just a brain health support group. And the reason I was motivated to do this is because we're right in the middle of we're in week five of a 12-week program to help people with diabetes who are overweight, high blood pressure, and elevated cholesterol. And a husband of one of the people, one of the women who's in the group, came and said, I wanted my wife to come. And I said, why? Well, because I was in your brain health support group 5 years ago, and I could only come to about 6 months of the meetings, and I couldn't come to the others because my job took me elsewhere. But I still followed the protocol, and my condition completely reversed, something doctor said was not possible. I said, well, we didn't know that. We never heard about it. So then I started thinking, how many other people could benefit? And so I've restructured a new 3-month program for helping people with dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, memory loss, depression, and anxiety, all of which impact the brain. And to get in, you're going to have proof that you have been diagnosed. Can't be just you feel something. You must have proof because it's a scientific study. And it'll be 3 months. I'll be meeting with people once a week for 3 months. And I'll tell you a little more a little later on about it. In any case, I believe that we have millions of Americans we could help. I know we can. We just have to share the information. So whenever you get information that you feel, and you must put it through your own litany, that you feel, litmus test, excuse me, that you feel is right, share it. This is from the Journal of Research. It says that a healthy lifestyle, neurology is the journal, you could reduce a woman's risk of a stroke by 50% with just lifestyle. Quote, healthy lifestyle, healthy diet, regular exercise, healthy BMI, which is percentage of body fat, may cut total stroke by women by 50%. Mind you, this does not include supplements. You could cut it by 100%. There's no reason any woman should ever have to die of a stroke if they knew which supplements and lifestyle and stressors. Now, why is this important? Because here's the bad side. 800,000 women have a stroke this year. It's the fourth leading cause of death. 130,000 Americans will die every year. And an unhealthy diet and lack of exercise and being overweight and stressed, those are the top reasons. You can add in high alcohol consumption and smoking also, but those are the top reasons. So this was a 10-year follow-up study, and they found that those who changed to a healthy lifestyle and exercise and dealt with stress reduced substantially by 50% stroke. So, for all of you who've been listening all these years, all these decades, think of the stroke you didn't have, the heart attack you didn't have, the cancer you didn't have, because of the choices you were making. The more choices you make, the more committed you are, the healthier you're going to be. And finally, U.S. culture is to blame for increased diabetes risk among Latinos living in America. From Temple University, quote, U.S. Latinos who more strictly adopt American behaviors and attitudes and values have a higher risk of diabetes, according to a new study from Temple University researchers. And the U.S. Latinos are growing at the fastest rate of any racial and ethnic group in the United States, and have the highest lifetime risk of diabetes. Researchers say that acculturation, or the process whereby individuals from one culture adapt the behaviors and attitudes and values of the prevailing culture, can increase the risk of diabetes among all Latinos. So, all groups. So, whether you're young, middle-aged, or older, and you're Latino, wow, all of them got sicker in this study that was followed for 3 years by the National Institute of Health. So we need to have support groups within the Latino community. So what I'm asking today is, if you are in this Latino community, if you are a church member, why don't you ask the people in the head of your church, why don't we help the whole congregation? I'm willing to go to any church or synagogue or mosque in this area and put together a whole health program with them. I'll teach them how to cook healthy. I'll give them menus, exercises, de-stressing, lifestyle changes, and do it as a whole congregation. And then once one congregation gets healthy and you have really markers, well, we lost so many thousands of pounds per the congregation, here's the medications they're no longer on because their doctors took them off or lowered their doses because they get so much healthier. Here are the people that had diabetes, don't have diabetes, had high blood pressure, don't have high blood pressure. We can do this. So if you're a Latino or an African American, you're at a much higher risk of being sick and dying. And I believe everyone should live a longer and healthier life. So let's do this through the religious institutions, because then you have a whole support system working with you every week. Individually, I'm helping people. I mean, half the people in our current health support group were either African American or Latino, probably 75%. So this is a call out to the religious community. All right? So get the head of your congregations and give us a call. You can call my office at 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422, and let's make this happen. All right? We're going to be back in a moment with my first guest. Remember, we're going to hear from Gary Webb today. Gary committed suicide. This was one of the last interviews he did, very important one, where he really lays out what happened. And you need to hear this. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome you all. I'm Gary Null. In a moment, we're going to talk with Louise Habakkus about fearless parenting, breaking away from the mainstream of corporate and medical parenting. Later, Gary Webb, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter whose career was destroyed when he told the truth about drugs in the African-American community being facilitated by the CIA. I want to go first, before we go to Louisa, I want to share this. I thought this was very important. This is from the staff of Truth Out, a really good article. It's called Watching Our Health Go Up in Smoke. I'm only going to give you a small part of it. You'll get the gist of it, and the whole article will be posted on our website. Quote, the medical waste incineration industry was given birth in the late 1980s by the confluence of two high-profile media circuses. One, the HIV hysteria, and two, multiple media accounts of bags of syringes, needles, plasma bags, IV tubing, bottles of pills, and even body parts washing up on the shores of some of the most popular resort beaches on the East Coast, stretching from Maine to Florida. In 1987, in Indianapolis, 12 children were found playing with HIV-infected vials of blood that came from an unsecured dumpster used by a medical clinic, in a classical case of the cure being worse than the disease, the knee-jerk response was for a widespread call to burn hospital waste so that the various avenues of incompetence, corruption, and profiteering that led to the dirty needles washing up on exclusive beaches could be closed down through a back door. Little thought was applied to the consequences of incineration until plumes of black clouds began billowing from hospital complexes. Neighbors complained. Air pollution research showed that those emissions were indeed dangerous, and the Environmental Protection Agency became involved. Eventually, the number of incinerators contracted out for was reduced, but in part because centralized incinerators became an easy solution. Hospitals washed their hands of the matter by allowing their waste to be burned in someone else's backyard. As a result, Stericycle, headquartered in Lake Forest, Illinois, became the king of the medical waste incineration industry outposts, operating six large incinerators throughout the country, including one of the largest medical incinerators west of the Mississippi in the heart of the most heavily populated part of Utah, the North Salt Lake subdivision of Foxborough, a few miles from my house. Stericycle now receives the medical waste of eight surrounding states. The relationship between Stericycle and Foxborough has always been tense. Efforts to shutter Stericycle was launched as long as 10 years ago by a handful of citizens concerned about the toxic brew that billows out of their short smokestack. It's no surprise that burning medical waste, just like burning fossil fuels or just about anything else, creates a pollution potpourri of hazardous chemicals and gases and heavy metals and particulate matter. Indeed, citizens' concerns are validated by hundreds of studies showing multiple adverse effects and outcomes among people exposed, including higher rates of cancers like childhood leukemia and adverse pregnancy outcomes that I've written about in a previous essay. The repercussions of the toxic incinerator emissions are made even more disturbing when adding the realization that the medical waste incineration industry was born on a false premise that hospital pathogens can be burned. An EPA report dating back 25 years cites numerous studies showing hospital waste presents no more risk of spreading infection than household waste, which harbors virtually all the same viruses and bacteria. In fact, according to the Society for Hospital Epidemiology of America, quote, household waste contains more microorganisms with pathogenic potential for humans on average than medical waste. So why single out medical waste? Scalpels and needles can be shredded without being burned. Many of the toxic chemicals and heavy metals in hospital waste are not destroyed by the incineration. In fact, burning medical waste is the worst possible way to manage it. While merely landfilling is a less than perfect solution, the possibility of contamination of usable groundwater is theoretical, not a certainty. Whereas with burning it, the emissions enter the air we all breathe, guaranteeing public exposure, especially for those closest to the incinerator. The ash left over from this process may be a smaller volume than the original waste, but is much more toxic and eventually has to be landfilled anyway. The burning does not prevent disease, it actually spreads disease. Burning not only does not remove toxins, it actually creates new ones and concentrates, mobilizes, and redistributes existing ones. Emissions from these burn factories are probably the most toxic type of air pollution there is, contaminated with the deadliest compounds known to science, designated by the EPA as HAP, hazardous air pollutants, which include dioxins, benzene, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, furans, heavy metals, and radioactive elements. Medical burners have even more deadly compounds not found in any other source, like residuals from chemotherapy drugs and even prions, the highly infective protein that causes the 100% fatal human mad cow disease. State health departments and environmental agencies are fond of claiming that toxicology assessments, the concentrations of many of these toxins are small enough to be written off as, quote, safe. These toxicology assessments ignore the biologic complexity of the exposure. Many of these toxins are bioaccumulative, meaning they build up in the human body insidiously over time and even higher concentrations in certain critical organs and tissues. Lipophilic, meaning fat-like toxins like dioxins, highly concentrated in human breast milk. Nursing infants consume 20 times or 2,000% more dioxin as the average adult. No toxicological assessments are even based upon the amount of dioxins in the human breast milk of people who live near these burn factories. Yet that undoubtedly is where dioxins wreak their greatest havoc on public health. Nor do those assessments consider the consequences of lipophilic toxins crossing the placenta that will primarily end up in the developing fetal brain. Because fat comprises 60% of the brain's structure matter and is the primary fat reserve in the fetus. Recently, new documents have been released that significantly raised the stakes in the long and sorry saga of this dying industry, whose flagship corporation villain is Stericycle. And there's also a documentary that features an undercover interview with an anonymous former Stericycle employee giving a credible, extraordinarily detailed account of fraudulent, illegal management practices far beyond what prompted the criminal investigation by state and federal enforcement. The whistleblower alleges shocking disregard for public and employee safety by Stericycle management, including directing employees to ignore the Geiger counter giving radioactive readings to the waste and to burn it anyway. Furthermore, he stated the Geiger counter didn't work much of the time. And so it goes. So just to let you all know that we should be focusing some of our attention, if we have or you have any of these incinerators in your neighborhood, get them closed down. They are toxic. You've been lied to. It's just another privatization of a public health need, and we have better ways of disposing of these toxic materials from hospitals than burning them, and then you all breathe what was burned, and it's not good. Let's now go over and say hello in Middletown, New Jersey, to Louise Habakus, H-A-B-A-K-U-S. She's the executive director of Fearless Parent and the director of the Center for Personal Rights, and which is an advocacy group organized to helping healthy parenting, education, and protection of vaccination choice as an essential human and civil right. She's co-founder, along with Allison McNeil, daughter of Robert McNeil from PBS's McNeil Lear and others, of Nurture Parenting and Fearless Parent, a grassroots community online. And she has an MBA from Stanford University and is co-author of Vaccine Epidemic, How Corporate Greed, Biased Science, and Coercive Government Threatens Our Human Rights, Our Health, and Our Children. Her website is fearless-parent.com. She's also the co-host of Fearless Parent Radio, which is also carried on Progressive Radio Network on Wednesday, 7 to 8 p.m. Nice to have you with us today.
It's great to be with you, Gary. Thank you.
First, I thought I'd like to get a response from you on two studies that just came in to my attention today. And one of them was the several studies report that unvaccinated children are healthier than those who were fully vaccinated. And this is from Lynn Griffith, quote, governments, pharmacists, and doctors alike are continuing to prescribe and recommend vaccinations despite reported links to various illness and birth defects. Countries research unvaccinated children despite ethical debate. And then they found out in a study completed in New Zealand, reported a tenfold, that's 1,000% increase in incidence of tonsillitis in children who were vaccinated, and a complete lack of tonsillectomy operations in children who did not receive vaccinations. And then there's Germany, Hong Kong, and New Zealand studies, three separate studies, all conclude that unvaccinated children are healthier than vaccinated children. Your thoughts on this, please?
Well, Gary, it comes as no surprise to me, and I'm sure it comes as no surprise to you either. I think that when people start reading the scientific literature, they understand that we are paying a very high price for this kind of temporary and extremely inadequate kind of immunity that we get through a needle. It is nothing remotely like Mother Nature intended when we contract disease and resolve it naturally. And so we are witnessing the price that we're paying in terms of a new normal of children that are devastatingly, chronically ill, neurodevelopmentally damaged at what's really an epidemic. So it doesn't surprise me at all. I think also anecdotally, what you will hear, and you know, it's funny, we all turn our noses up again, you know, when we hear anecdotes, right? Because anecdotes do not science make. But I think people forget that, you know, science is at its heart about observation. And if government and industry and medical associations will not help to do the science, then we have to be connecting the dots. And when you look at children who are not vaccinated, and you hear from their parents, and you look at homeschool communities, you look at children in Amish communities and chiropractors' kids, you will see and hear that these children are a lot healthier. So it doesn't surprise me at all.
Parents are constantly bombarded, especially through the media and news clips and television talk programs that hosts are so-called experts who are supposed to know the very best way to raise children. However, what we've witnessed during the ascendancy of this bromatic cast of experts is less healthy American children than ever before, rise in bullying, epidemic of ADHD and other neurological learning disorders, and a completely broken educational system, and a generation of severe dysfunctional outcasts within the youth movements and a lot of children. So first, what do you observe as being the fundamental causes, including the cultural fear that is intertwined in mainstream parenting, that has led to mainstream parenting turning into such a disaster? And second, how would you define and explain this dominant cultural groupthink that today controls the media and professional dialogue of right versus wrong parenting, and in fact reflects this dysfunction?
So that's a mouthful, Gary. Let me start, and you can interrupt, and you know, we can have a conversation about this. I believe that what's happened is what's being called the expertization of parenting. And essentially what you have are a number of industrial and large corporate entities that are looking to have parents turn over their power to so-called experts who are actually beholden. And these people are, unbeknownst to many, many of us, industry spokespeople. And yet they stand on a platform and they use their professional credentials and they pretend, in a way, because they're being paid, Gary, to say things like, children, it's okay if they wear diapers until they're 3, 4, or 5 years old, right? And even though children back in the day when you were a child and I was a child, children were potty training much earlier, we hear from a doctor by the name of Dr. Brazelton, who was hired by Kimberly Clark, and he started saying that it was okay for children to potty train and to wear diapers into, you know, advanced ages. We see that also with vaccination, Gary. You know, you'll hear from the good Dr. Paul Offit and others who are actually receiving honoraria, grants, patent royalties.
Millions, from, millions of dollars.
Millions of dollars. Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, I think what parents are seeing is, you know, this isn't really working out so well for us, right? I mean, we're turning to the experts. They're not trustworthy. And then, you know, parents are left holding the bag. You know, we have the sick kids. We have the kids who can't pay attention, the children who have allergies and, you know, we fear for their lives when they step out the door. And so what's happening is that parents are networking themselves. They are proactively reaching out. They're reading the science. They're finding their own experts. They are standing, Gary, on a foundation that you helped to build, because what's happening is there are now alternate platforms. So we're turning off the television. We're not listening to mainstream news anymore because we understand that it's not really news. It's become this kind of highly produced infomercials. And so with this savvy understanding of the way the world works, right? You sort of look at it and you say, okay, I understand what business is. I understand how politics works. And I understand that medicine today is different, that doctors are actually, most of them, quite irrelevant in the equation. And parents are saying, you know what, we're gonna forge a different way. We're not going to be controlled by fear. And frankly, they're saying, I don't even care what you think. I don't care what you call me. You cannot bully me into doing something that I don't want to do, that's not in the best interests for my kids or my family. And so I'm not going to play your game. I'm in charge. And, you know, this is where the rubber meets the road, and this is where people get really agitated, right? Like you hear the anger and the vitriol, and it's because the reality is that parents are the ones that have all the power. We are the ones who can decide and say, you know what, I don't think so. We're not going to do that. No, thank you. And then we can just walk out the door.
What I hear you saying, and I want to make sure I'm not misquoting you, is that we should be more responsible in creating a parenting paradigm that is disconnected from corporate and commercial interest and look at the well-being and benefit of initiating children through the various phases of a holistic, healthy development into adulthood, and only use the medical and mental health industry as a last resort, not as a primary vehicle for guidance.
100%, Gary. There are kids. There are kids, and we have to stop asking doctors and others for permission to raise our children in the way that we believe is the right way, you know? I mean, think about it. We go to the pediatrician because they tell us that they need to go at 2, 4, 6, 8, 12, 15, and 18, 24 months of age. And you know what happens in those quote-unquote well visits, right? I mean,
I refuse to take my daughter. My daughter was never vaccinated. She's never been sick, and she's 6 foot tall, has a dynamic immune system. No, I'm sorry, I haven't had those conversations.
Right. Well, you know what? And this is an absolute trend. Parents are firing their children's pediatricians. They're actually taking doctors out of the equation. They're going to different clinicians and providers, and increasingly, these practitioners don't even have medical degrees. They're going to chiropractors. They're going to homeopaths. They're going to naturopaths. You know, they're wanting a different kind of relationship with a healthcare provider, and one that's not fear-based and you know, a bullying kind of interchange. Because, you know, honestly, a lot of parents, a lot of moms, before they go to the pediatrician, a lot of them are totally stressed out. They don't want to go. They don't want to have the conversation. They don't want the vaccines.
And they're educated. Do you realize that the top person on a major study on vaccines, the MMR vaccine, just said that he would never vaccinate his child with the vaccine he was promoting in the article on the CDC because it contained mercury?
Well, the MMR vaccine, Gary, actually doesn't contain mercury.
No. It was the flu vaccine. He wouldn't. He was the author on MMR vaccine, but he wouldn't give a flu vaccine because it contained mercury.
Now, you know, there are some flu shots that do not contain mercury, and mercury is not the only thing that's problematic in vaccines. But absolutely, Gary, I mean, I can't tell you how many people, experts that I've spoken with, doctors, scientists, you know, they will say, some of them will say courageously and out in the open, and others will say, you know, quietly in private conversations, the way that we vaccinate children today is unprecedented in the history of not just the United States, but unprecedented in the history of man. You know, we have never exposed children starting on the day of birth with this many toxins and pathogens and attempted to stimulate the immune system in such an atypical, bizarre way. We've never done that before. And so, you know, when you hear people like, Lou Cooper, who is the co-founder of the rubella vaccine, and he says, well, clinical evidence shows that these things are safe. And I say to him, are you kidding me? look at our children today. No one would say that children are well today. You've got upwards of close to 60% of children who are either obese or chronically ill or at risk of or having neurodevelopmental damage.
Louise, you're right, and good for you for being out there and debating them. I really support all of your efforts in educating the people. We're out of time for this segment. Louise Habakus, you can hear her program, and it's a really popular program on parenting, and just go to her website. I thank you very much for being with us, and keep up the good work with all that you're doing out there. And the website is fearless-parent.com. And she's on Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network. I want to tell all of our stations that syndicate this program around the country, please allow this last interview to go a little long, just a few minutes longer than normal. It's Gary Webb in one of his very last, if not his very last interview, on what he was facing. And I'd done many interviews with Gary Webb. But this is after he had been blackballed and lambasted by the New York Times and the Washington Post. And I want you to hear this. Also, I'm going to go to the premiere of the movie based upon his life tonight. It's at 8 o'clock at 68th and Broadway. I suggest you call and get a reservation. You're not going to be able to get in otherwise. It'll be packed. It's at the Lowe's 68th and Broadway, 8 p.m. showing. And because he deserves to be remembered for the courage that he had. Here's Gary Webb.
My guest today is Gary Webb. Gary, of course, is the person who wrote the book Dark Alliance, and he's with us now. Since I have not heard from the producers of the CNN special to get their side of it and their researchers, I'm certainly not going to assume that the story is not an accurate story, because what if we would have accepted the same from all the papers that attacked Gary Webb? Well, then we would have assumed that there was no crack cocaine epidemic, the CIA did not know about the smuggling of cocaine for drugs and the drugs for money for the Contras, but he's here to refute all that. Are you there, Gary?
Yes, I am.
Why don't we take a look now at that part of the story where your own paper began to question you and started to line up against you along with the other papers. Let's see, who were the journalists and the papers and the media people who attacked you?
Well, there were a couple of them. The first shots came from a fellow named Walter Pincus at the Washington Post, who covered the CIA for a number of years, allegedly covered the Iran-Contra scandal, although I'm not sure how good that was. But, you know, he did a story saying that, well, there's no evidence that there was a CIA plot, which, of course, nobody had ever alleged. You know, it was the CIA was defending itself from something nobody had ever accused it of. All we said in the series was that these men had met with CIA agents, these traffickers were meeting with CIA agents before and during the time they were selling this cocaine. We said that money from this operation was going to a CIA-run army, which was never been denied, and that there was indications in federal records that we'd seen that the CIA was aware of what these men were doing. We didn't say that they were out selling drugs themselves. We didn't say the CIA agents were standing on street corners offering crack pipes to passersby. What we said was that these men had some connection with the agency, and it seemed impossible that this, you know, agents that we pay $27 billion a year for to find out what's going on didn't know this. But that was spun into an allegation that we were making that the CIA started the crack epidemic, or that, you know, they targeted black America for genocide. And that's a very easy thing to knock down, because, you know, I don't believe that's true either. But that sort of set the tone for the rest of the media, and they all piled on after that and said, well, there's no evidence of a CIA plot. There's no evidence of targeting black Americans. And it's true, there isn't any evidence, but nobody ever said there was. But that was sort of the tenor of the attacks. And, you know, the problem is that in journalism, frankly, and I was in it for 20 years, a lot of reporters aren't very smart, and they don't read very, very carefully, and they don't have a lot of time to do stories. And so a lot of things get sort of turned and twisted in the retelling. And gradually what happened was that a story that really had no factual errors in it was presented as discredited or debunked, similar to what's going on with the CNN story. I mean, I haven't seen, and I read that report, as I said, I haven't seen a situation where they found that there was anything untrue in what they broadcast or inaccurate in what they broadcast. But it's being presented now as having been debunked. The producers have been discredited and they're unreliable. And so really, I mean, it's a pattern. And I think when you're dealing with this sort of story, you have to sort of look at, you have to become adept at pattern recognition. And, you know, it's the same pattern is happening now with those folks at CNN that happened with me.
Have you been in touch with the producers?
I was on a radio show in Seattle with one of them, Jack Smith, and I also saw them on Crossfire not too long ago. And they are, you know, standing behind their story. I mean, and really, there's no reason not to. They had people on the record, and the criticism of them was, well, the one source they used, one of the sources they used is Admiral Moore, who just happens to be the former head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. We're told, well, he's 87 years old, you know, as if once you reach a certain age, you become unbelievable anymore. And the other source they used, who was the platoon commander or the second in command of this platoon that went in there and allegedly gassed these American deserters, well, he had nervous problems afterwards. Well, I wouldn't be surprised, but that doesn't make him, you know, unbelievable. So this is the kind of stuff that's being thrown against these reporters, and they got thrown out. I mean, they were fired by CNN. And I just think it's a very, it's sort of the nadir of investigative journalism today. And I don't think you're going to see much of it in the future because reporters are now being held to these unattainable standards of proof without really the tools to get it.
Let's go into your story a little more in depth. Let's take a look at what was really happening both in Nicaragua and getting the cocaine out and getting the arms in and how that was a whole illegal operation from day one.
Right. Well, what was going on was, I mean, the Nicaraguans that I wrote about, the head of it was named Norwin Meneses, the head of this drug ring. He had been a drug smuggler since the 1970s. He had an existing cocaine smuggling operation going on. And the Contras, when they started out, they needed a lot of money because wars are very expensive to fight, and the Reagan administration had only allocated $19 million for it, which is nothing when you're trying to start a war. So they piggybacked onto this cocaine operation, this existing cocaine operation, and used some of the money to buy weapons. The traffickers who were involved in this were not just drug traffickers. They were also arms dealers. And they were supplying the Contras with weapons. They were selling the gangs in Los Angeles automatic weapons. A lot of them, a lot of the people around Ricky Ross, who was the crack wholesaler, said that they bought weapons from these Nicaraguans. They were buying AR-15s. They were buying Uzis. One of them bought a tripod-mounted 50-caliber machine gun. They were going to buy a grenade launcher until one of them figured out that they'd probably never get a chance to use it. I mean, so this is really sort of a nightmare drug ring. I mean, these guys were selling them weapons. They were selling them eavesdropping devices so they could figure out if the cops were on to them. They were selling them voice scramblers so they could, if they were being wiretapped, they couldn't understand the conversations. And they were also being warned to stay away from certain locations. And invariably, the police would raid these locations a couple of days later. So somebody was looking out for these traffickers. I mean, you know, the guy that was Ricky Ross was, he was a good drug dealer, but he was fairly uneducated. So, you know, it's impossible to believe that he could have done all this by himself without help. And what happened was, over the course of the decade that they were bringing this cocaine in, one way or another would get compromised, and so they would shift to another transportation route. And the most bizarre one they used was in mid-80s when they started bringing the cocaine from Colombia into an air base in El Salvador called Ilopango, which was being used at that time by the CIA and the National Security Council to for for air resupply of the Contras in Costa Rica primarily. And the cocaine was flying into these two hangars at Ilopango, Hangar 4 and 5. And the DEA agent who was assigned to El Salvador at the time was a fellow named Celerino Castillo, and he got wind that drugs were coming in and out of these hangars at this airbase, and actually put together an investigation and started sending reports to Washington saying, you know, the Contras are flying drugs in and out of these hangars on this military airbase. And what happened to him is he eventually became under investigation by the DEA, and they ran him out of the DEA for, you know, administrative failures, you know, loaning a gun to an informant, things like that. But the stuff was coming in. According to the information we found at a trial in Nicaragua, the cocaine was leaving El Salvador on Salvadoran military aircraft and was being flown into a military airbase outside of Fort Worth, Texas, which I believe was Carswell Air Force Base. And allegedly, that was transshipped to the West Coast from there. This is not something that we found when we were working on it. This was something we found in court files in Nicaragua that dated from 1992. I mean, this was years before we even started working on the story. So, you know, when you're a reporter and you find contemporaneous or near contemporaneous information like that, it sort of tells you you're on the right track. And the editors of the Mercury, you know, this thing was edited for months and months and months. Believe me, if you're going to write a story that suggests the CIA was involved in drug trafficking, it's not something you walk to your editor with and say, I'd like to do this tomorrow. You know, these things are fact-checked, they're edited, the documents are required. And this went on for months and months, and finally we got to the point where everybody was happy with what we wrote, and we put it in the paper.
And that's Gary Webb. We're out of time. I want to thank the stations for this little extended opportunity. The full interview can be downloaded from the archives at progressiveradionetwork.com, and also watch the film to see how much of his legacy is truly represented. And then we'll have some comments on. Look forward to seeing some of you at the theater tonight, because I'm going to get out and see at the 8 o'clock show at 68th and Broadway. Let's just say very quickly hello to Luann Panessi, because Luann, some people may want to participate in the brain healing 3-month program that starts second week of November. Could you give me your number, please?
Surely. It's 631-504-6198. Again, 631-504-6198. If I'm not there, leave a message. I return all my calls within 24 hours.
Thank you. I want to say thank you for everyone. Look forward to seeing you on our next program. Now let's say hello to Utrice. Hi, Utrice.
Hi, Gary. It's Free Your Mind Friday on Lead Stories, and listeners have their say.
Are you coming to New York next week?
I'm hoping to.
Great.
I'm just making the final arrangements now.
We're looking forward to it. Utrice, lead right now.